Take a look across America and you can find more than 1.5 million adopted children under the age of 18. That number grows by more than 100,000 every year. One question is, how is their emotional health affected? Michelle Trudeau reports that researchers now have an answer.
People have wondered for a long time whether children who were adopted in infancy are at increased risk for psychological problems. Now, in the first study of its kind, research psychologist Margaret Keyes actually tested the psychological well-being of adopted teenagers.
We assembled a sample of 692 adopted adolescents, all of whom had been adopted prior to 2 years of age.
In fact, the average child in this study went to live with their new family at only 4 months of age. When Keyes tested them, they were around 15 years old. They were given in-depth psychological interviews, checking for depression, anxiety, ADHD, and something called oppositional defiant disorder, or ODD.
These are kids who argue with their parents, who refuse to follow through on chores, maybe argue with their teachers, blame other people for their own mistakes.
More than just a negative teenager, ODD is persistent hostility and disobedience. For comparison, Keyes gave the same extensive psychological workup to a group of teenagers raised by their biological parents. The results are published this month in the Archives of Pediatric and Adolescent Medicine.
We found that most of the adolescents, adopted and non-adopted, were psychologically healthy. Overwhelmingly psychologically healthy.
That being said, Keyes did find what she calls an adoption effect.
There's a slightly increased risk for the adopted kids, especially ADHD and oppositional defiant disorder.
This risk was doubled in the adopted teenagers. Keyes explains.
So if you look at something like ADHD, for the non-adopted kids, about 7 out of every 100 had a diagnosis of ADHD. For the adopted kids, it's more like 14 or 15 out of every 100.
And similarly for oppositional defiant disorder, ODD, nearly a doubling of the risk. But there was no increased risk among adopted teenagers for depression or anxiety or for a form of serious delinquency that involves aggression, truancy, vandalism, and the like. David Brodzinski is professor emeritus from Rutgers University, a leader in the field of adoption research. He's not surprised that some psychological problems were doubled in a group of adopted children.
Many of the serious problems associated with adoption have less to do with adoption per se than with what happens before adoption.
Such as genetic factors, the health of the biological parents, possible exposure to alcohol or drugs in utero. All these before factors impact the later mental health of a child. Brodzinski's own research finds that adopting parents are a special breed, highly motivated, better educated, better off financially than non-adopting parents. And now Margaret Keyes adds to this list, adopting parents were also more likely to get help from mental health professionals for their adopted child when behavioral problems arose. There's one more provocative finding from this study. Adopted children born in another country, most in this study came from South Korea, had slightly less ADHD than adopted children born in the United States. It's not clear why this may be the case. For NPR News, I'm Michelle Trudeau.
It's been a year now since NPR News started a journey around the world. Our series Climate Connections with National Geographic explored how we are changing the planet and how the climate changes us. This morning, the journey is over. It ends in a city that tries to change nothing. It's a city intended to burn no gas or oil, so its contribution to greenhouse gases will be minimal. NPR's Joe Palca visited the site near the Abu Dhabi airport in the Persian Gulf, where the city will be built.
You have to have a good imagination to picture what the spot I'm standing in is going to look like in 10 years. I'm at the edge of what will be a 6 square kilometer city housing 50,000 people. Right now, it doesn't look like much except a windswept desert.
Imagine.
So to help with our imagination, the people building Masdar have produced this promotional video.
The open spaces are shaded and cool, even during the hottest times of the day.
The streets are narrow with high sides and overhangs, providing shade within the city.
Although the buildings will be thoroughly modern, the architects are trying to capture the flavor of an ancient Arabic city. It turns out that copying those old designs will help them reach their ambitious energy goals.
Mazda will be the first city where carbon emissions are zero, where waste is converted to energy and reduced to zero, and 80% of water will be recycled. This is the city of the future.
It certainly sounds convincing, at least the way that slick announcer guy says it. But let's take a closer look.
Mazda will be the first city where carbon emissions are zero.
How do you bring carbon emissions to zero? Well, some of it's common sense. Narrow streets and shaded walks will reduce the need for air conditioning. That isn't rocket science. Some of it will involve new technologies, such as larger and more efficient solar electricity generators. And finally, cars will be banned from the city. So to replace the cars, the city's designers are turning to something called a PRT system, Personal Rapid Transit.
And really all it is a car.
Scott McWiggin is with CH2M Hill, the construction firm that's building Mazda.
It's a simple vehicle, 6 passengers. It's designed like a car, but obviously it's powered by solar energy with batteries.
These solar-powered cars will run under the city, just like a subway system. But the cars won't run on fixed routes. Basically, they'll take you anywhere you want to go.
So you jump into it, there's about 1,500 stations. You program what station you want to go to, and it will directly take you to that station. You know, if you look at things like Blade Runner, etc., it's really bringing that to the fore now.
So PRTs and solar get you part of the way to zero carbon. Now let's look at some of the other claims made by that oh-so-slick announcer guy.
And 80% of water will be recycled.
Saving water is critical because it takes energy to make water in Masdar. You have to convert salty water from the Gulf into fresh water. But saving water means changing business as usual.
We have a fairly linear process normally. We kind of take water in through the tap, we use it, and then it goes straight in the drain. So it gets used once.
Peter Sherritt is with WSP, a British energy consulting firm. The plan at Masdar will be to reuse water as many times as possible. One idea involves capturing whatever's left after you water adjacent farm fields and parks.
So when you put the water onto the ground, when it has gone through the kind of top 2-3 feet and has actually met the needs and requirements of the plant, there are then collection systems embedded in the below ground to recover that.
The water can then be used to irrigate another day, or whatever else it's needed for. So that's the plan for conserving water. What about that other claim, no waste at all?
Mazda will be the first city where waste is converted to energy and reduced to zero.
When they say reduced to zero, in reality it'll be reduced to very close to zero, since some stuff just can't be converted to energy or recycled. But when it comes to, how can I put this delicately, human waste, Peter Sherritt says that will all be repurposed.
To recover those nutrients and actually use them to create soil, which can then be used as part of the landscaping, and also a component of the sewage sludge will again go for a waste-to-power scheme.
The strategy to reuse or recycle as much as possible permeates the planning for Masdar. Construction manager Scott McWiggin says it's a bit of a game, always looking for materials that can be reused. Take the fencing around the construction site.
We're looking at recyclable plastic for site fencing. And at the end of that, we can sell that back to the manufacturer. He can recycle that or resell that on again. So it has a useful life at the end of our life that we are using it for.
They've even begun to think about how to recycle the concrete used to build Masdar. And that's before the first building's even finished. Now, remember how we started out exploring the claims of Masdar City.
Mazda will be the first city where carbon emissions are zero.
The idea is to build a city that will have no carbon footprint. But obviously, because a lot of construction equipment uses gas, there's going to be some CO2 going into the atmosphere. The planners say they'll offset that by planting trees or putting surplus solar energy back into the Abu Dhabi power grid. But calculating your carbon footprint is trickier than just measuring how much diesel fuel you burn. Liz Darley is with the British firm BioRegional. Her job is to oversee Masdar's carbon calculations. When my producer Rebecca Davis and I visited her in London, she pointed out there are a lot of things you could include in the carbon footprint.
What they're currently doing is deciding where that boundary is drawn, and that is in itself quite a complex thing to decide on as a project team. because it could include all the carbon expenditure of flying between Europe and the Middle East that the design team is incurring. It could go to the extent of you guys coming here to interview us. Once you start peeling back the layers of the onion, it just goes on and on and on forever.
So achieving the goal of being a zero carbon city can be made easy or very, very hard, depending on where you draw your boundaries. Skeptics say reducing Masdar's total carbon footprint to zero will be difficult, if not impossible. And besides, they say, Masdar City is only 50,000 people. The millions of others living in the United Arab Emirates are still guzzling gas like, well, like we are in this country. Khaled Awad is in charge of turning the plans for Masdar City into a reality. He's heard the skeptics, but to them he says, bring it on. Tell us where we can make improvements in our plans, and we'll make them.
Look, we're serious about this. We're going to put so much resources to do it right. And this is the ideal place where you can demonstrate what you believe in a scale that will make it a meaningful scale.
This is not a single building or just a neighborhood. It's a city of 50,000 people. The plan is to build Masdar City in record time. The first building should be up by the end of the summer. Will it meet its ambitious energy goals? Maybe. But even the skeptics admit it's worth a try. Joe Palca, NPR News.
Masdar. Shahidun. على حياة المستقبل العصرية.
To see a fly-through animation of how city planners envision Masdar City, visit npr.org/climateconnections, where you can also find all the stories in this series and videos from public television's Wild Chronicles. Let's talk next about the next generation of American business leaders and the education they receive. Marshall University in West Virginia is debating whether to accept a $1 million donation from BB&T Bank's Charitable Foundation. The money would go toward teaching courses at the business college based on the economic philosophy of the writer Ayn Rand. Clark Davis of West Virginia Public Broadcasting has more.
BB&T CEO John Allison says the author Ayn Rand has changed his life.
My favorite book is Atlas Shrugged, which is the best defense, I believe, of capitalism ever written.
Over the last 3 years, Allison has helped ensure that Rand's philosophy receives attention at 25 colleges and universities. At Marshall, a $1 million grant would help create the BB&T Center for the Advancement of American Capitalism. Professor Cal Kent will direct the center. He says BB&T officials just want to give students an additional perspective on capitalism.
In my experience, you're not able to propagandize students, and BB&T recognizes that, and certainly that is not our intent in this course, and if it were our intent, we would be doomed for failure from the beginning.
At least one college has turned down BB&T's money. 2 years ago, faculty at Meredith College in North Carolina rejected $420,000. Professor Beth Mulvaney says many faculty were concerned the money would be used to promote economic propaganda, but that ultimately faculty didn't want to let a corporation have a role in curriculum.
The main concern that I heard articulated was the concern that no one outside of this college should ever tell an instructor what the reading for a course should be.
There are different definitions of Ayn Rand's philosophy. Critics like Rick Wilson often seize on what they consider its selfish aspects. Wilson, a sociology instructor at Marshall, heads what's called the West Virginia Economic Justice Project.
I think it's a curious interpretation of philanthropy to use corporate funding to promote sort of an extreme ideology. Ayn Rand's philosophy, which she called objectivism, is based on the view that selfishness is the only moral value, which seems kind of paradoxical. It goes against, I think, the collective wisdom of the human race pretty much everywhere.
Despite the criticism by some professors at Marshall University, Faculty Senate President Larry Stickler says it's too early to judge the course's merit. Dan Holbrook of the History Department, who at first objected, now says he's willing to give the course a chance.
I think that it's very easy to blow this out of proportion, and that I think the smart thing to do is to wait and see exactly how they teach those books. Because there's no one right way to teach those books, or to even read those books.
Rand is also the author of The Virtue of Selfishness. But Marshall's Cal Kent says her philosophy isn't so scary.
It's based on the idea of individualism, and what that means is individual choice. That means the freedom of individuals to contract with other people, the freedom to choose their occupations, the freedom to do what they see as being in their own best self-interest with the resources that they have.
Kent says BB&T probably wants to help business schools develop students that meet the bank's employment needs.
I'm sure it's not all altruism on their part, that this is really a way for them to get a foot in the door, a very large foot in the door in the recruiting process for better students.
Yes, Ayn Rand has written a book that is one of the best writings of the moral defense of capitalism.
Phyllis Arnold is president of BB&T's West Virginia operations.
But the subject at hand is forwarding and supporting the discussion and the knowledge of what capitalism brings to the success of our democracy and to the overall economic success of the country.
The course will be offered to both business and non-business majors starting next school year. For NPR News, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington, West Virginia.
The U.S. military has been retraining to face even more extreme forms of disorder in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. The Army struggled in recent years to change its focus, to worry less about big conventional battles with rival armies and learn more about counterinsurgency battles among civilians with irregular groups. Now, an internal Pentagon report is asking if that shift went too far. The authors of the report are all Army colonels with significant combat experience. And they write that, quote, the Army is mortgaging its ability to successfully fight in future conventional battles. The report obtained by NPR is the latest twist in an ongoing debate. And as NPR's defense correspondent Guy Raz reports, that debate is getting personal.
A couple of weeks ago, Defense Secretary Robert Gates sent a subtle but unmistakable message to the Army when he announced
General David Petraeus as the new commander of Central Command.
As head of Central Command, Petraeus will oversee the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The post is arguably the highest profile assignment in the U.S. military today. And Petraeus's elevation to head Central Command is, in a sense, an affirmation.
An affirmation of the fact that the counterinsurgency doctrine he wrote and the counterinsurgency strategy he implemented in Iraq was successful.
This is Lieutenant Colonel John Nagel. Nagel's one of the Army's top experts on counterinsurgency doctrine. His book on counterinsurgency, Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, is a modern classic on the subject. Nagel served a tour in Iraq from 2003 to 2004, where he was based in Anbar province. It was there that he realized the U.S. Army had gotten itself tangled up in an insurgency.
And so what I saw was an army that was not as ready to fight this kind of war as it should have been. And so I came back from Iraq determined to help the army learn how to do this kind of war more effectively.
So Nagel got to work on the Army's Counterinsurgency Handbook, better known as Field Manual 3-24. The manual is like a roadmap for officers. It emphasizes the use of minimal force. The idea, Nagel explains in a counterinsurgency campaign, is to drive a wedge between the civilian population and the insurgents who live among them. Colonel Peter Mansour, a top aide to General Petraeus, also helped write the manual. Mansour, who spoke from Baghdad, is part of General Petraeus's famed brain trust of advisors, a group of officers and civilians who live and breathe counterinsurgency doctrine.
The people are the prize in a counterinsurgency operation. They are the key terrain, if you will, on which victory or defeat rests.
Now, the man most closely identified with counterinsurgency doctrine is General David Petraeus. Petraeus oversaw the writing of Field Manual 3-24, and when he testified in front of Congress last month, Petraeus highlighted the doctrine as a reason for the decline in violence in Iraq.
A second factor has been the employment of coalition and Iraqi forces in the conduct of counterinsurgency operations across the country.
Within the obsessive and rarefied world of what's known as the counterinsurgency community, or in shorthand, the COIN community, Petraeus is practically regarded as the son of God. And soldiers like Peter Mansour and John Nagel are viewed as the apostles. So is an Army colonel named Sean McFarland. McFarland was among the first to successfully apply counterinsurgency doctrine in Iraq back in 2006. And yet, a recent internal Army report McFarland co-authored implies that the Army is far too focused on counterinsurgency training. And this singular focus, he writes, is weakening the Army. The example he gives is what he calls the alarming deterioration of the Army's field artillery units. Since 1775, the year America's Army was founded, artillery units have served as the backbone of the force. But today, 90% of artillery units are uncertified. They're not ready for battle. And a major reason why is because artillery soldiers are doing other jobs. Now, McFarland declined to be interviewed for this story, but views like his have been amplified publicly by an iconoclastic Berkeley-educated officer named Lieutenant Colonel John Gentile.
The high public profile of the new counterinsurgency manual, combined with the perception that its use in practice with the surge in Iraq has lowered violence, I think has had a Svengali effect on us. It's almost like we have a secret recipe now for success in almost any situation involving counterinsurgency in a regular war.
Gentile, who now chairs the history department at West Point, has many silent supporters in the Army, but he's also been loudly criticized. In a recent posting on a counterinsurgency blog, Colonel Mansour accused Lieutenant Colonel Gentile of misreading the history of what's happening in Iraq. In response, Gentile charged Mansour with overstating the success of counterinsurgency tactics. Still, Mansour insists that the Army's current training regimen is spot on.
The wars we're fighting now are counterinsurgency wars. And for those who argue that the Army and the Marine Corps and, in fact, the whole military should go back to training for high-intensity combat operations, my response would be we have two wars that we're fighting now, and we need to prosecute them to the best of our ability.
Mansour's fellow counterinsurgency guru, Lieutenant Colonel John Nagel, is convinced that irregular warfare and counterinsurgency campaigns will define what the U.S. military will do in the future.
War in the information age is war that in which our enemies will fight us using information age weapons, precision-guided missiles, cell phones, the internet, all of the implements of technology that the information age allows, but they will also use them in an agricultural age manner, drawing upon the strengths of tribes and basic family units, and they will wage war from among the peoples.
Retired Army Colonel Douglas McGregor doesn't necessarily dispute that. His problem is with the way the Army defines counterinsurgency doctrine and the narrative the Army's attached to its purported success in Iraq. McGregor, a man whose research helped transform the Army's organizational structure back in the 1990s, disputes the idea that the Army's adoption of counterinsurgency has made it into a better force. And he argues that that viewpoint encourages a more interventionist posture within the Army, a position that will make it far easier, he says, for the Army to wage war in the future.
I think it's downright dangerous because it suggests that we can repeat the folly of Iraq, that somehow or another next time we can get it right, without understanding that if the population is living within a social structure that doesn't want to change, if the population doesn't want you in the country, if there is no legitimate government to begin with, your intervention is doomed to inevitable failure.
But men like McGregor and Gentile are swimming against a powerful current. Counterinsurgency doctrine is intimately tied to a new role the Army has formally carved out for itself. Earlier this year, the Army added stability operations to its growing portfolio of jobs. And so a mission once derided as nation-building and peacekeeping by powerful figures in the Bush administration is now a key part of how the Army sees its role around the world. Guy Raz, NPR News, Washington.
That report is at NPR.org. It's a story you'll only hear on Morning Edition from NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. We're going to check up now on mortgage lenders who say they're following the rules. Now, it's pretty clear that lending industry was out of control in recent years. That's how millions of people wound up in loans that they can't pay back. Now they say they've changed. The companies do. But one homeowner we found says that does not seem to be the case at Countrywide, the nation's largest home lender. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
Julie Santaboni just had an experience with Countrywide that she couldn't believe, especially given what a mess we're in with the housing market and all the foreclosures.
That's why it made me so mad. This didn't happen 4 years ago. This happened now when everybody is awake to the problems that can result from bad loans.
When it comes to getting a mortgage, Santaboni didn't just fall off a potato truck. She's owned several homes. She's an economic analyst, and her husband's a mathematician. Their house in Washington, D.C. is half paid off, but they have an adjustable rate loan and were looking to refinance.
Rates have come down a lot, so I wanted to just take advantage of the lower rates and get a fixed rate.
On March 19th, Santaboni called Countrywide on an 800 number and told the loan officer her situation. She'd taken the past 2 years off work to be with her kids, so the family's income was a little low. She says the Countrywide loan officer's answer to that was to have her lie about her income. Since her husband had the word manager in his job title,
he said that he could bump his income up. And I had asked how he could do it, and he was rather elusive about how. But he said he could change it. And if it was a manager, then the underwriters wouldn't be as questioning. And I said, but our taxes don't reflect it, and his boss will not verify that that is indeed his income. And basically, he said, don't worry about it. I'll deal with it.
A lot of people think it was this kind of coaching from aggressive mortgage brokers that got so many people to lie about their incomes and get into loans that they couldn't afford. Santaboni says the Countrywide loan officer also wanted her to write a letter saying she made $60,000 over each of the past 2 years and get her accountant to sign it, even though that would have been a totally fraudulent document. She hasn't even been working.
And I told them that. I told him that I was extremely uncomfortable doing it, and I don't feel comfortable lying, and I don't want to. And he said, well, the rate's really good, so you might want to lock it in. And then I said, I don't want to. And he said, well, it's only $450.
Santaboni also asked how much the closing costs were. And after persisting a bit, she says she got the Countrywide loan officer to tell her the fees would be $10,000. She says the loan officer told her those were standard fees in the industry, which she knew wasn't true. And she says he kept hard selling her.
Very hard sell. Your rates are going to go up. They keep fluctuating. You're lucky to have called today. I mean, it was really every sleazy move in the book.
Santaboni got the loan officer's name and title. She thinks the call was recorded. Countrywide declined an interview, but it said in a statement it is now looking into the incident and that, quote, the alleged conduct would not be in keeping with Countrywide's ethical standards, stated policies, and approved practices. Santaboni says, though, at one point another Countrywide salesperson called her to follow up, and she told the woman about the guy trying to get her to lie on her loan application.
And her response was, uh-huh. And that was it. She hung up.
Santaboni's hoping she gets a better response from Countrywide's regulators. She's filed a formal complaint with the Federal Office of Thrift Supervision, or OTS. Montrese Goddard-Yakimov oversees compliance and consumer complaints for OTS.
I can't comment on the specifics of this complaint because it's under active investigation.
Yakimov says OTS takes such complaints very seriously. Ira Reingold is the head of the National Association of Consumer Advocates. He thinks such investigations often don't amount to much. He wants tougher rules and better monitoring of lenders. And he's not surprised to hear about this complaint against Countrywide.
A leopard doesn't change its spots that quickly. Countrywide and companies like it had a pervasive culture of cheating. And they've been slapped on the wrist.
Julie Santaboni, the homeowner, says as somebody who works in the financial world, she's not a fan of overregulation. But if lenders aren't cleaning up their own act after all we've been through with the subprime lending implosion,
they should regulate the hell out of them if this is what's going to happen. Because it's still going on.
Meanwhile, Santaboni is waiting to hear whether her complaint will result in any real consequences for Countrywide. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
This week, psychiatrists are gathering from around the world for a meeting of the American Psychiatric Association, a meeting here in Washington, D.C. One topic of research and concern, the overdiagnosis of bipolar disorder. As NPR's John Hamilton reports, some patients are being told they have bipolar disorder, even though they don't.
Bipolar disorder used to be called manic depressive illness. People who have it may swing from sad and listless to energized and euphoric, and then back again. It can be tricky to diagnose, so for the past decade, Mark Zimmerman has been studying how doctors are doing. Zimmerman works at Rhode Island Hospital and Brown University. He says at first he found that doctors tended to miss bipolar disorder. But about 6 years ago, the opposite problem began to surface.
Individuals were coming to us saying that they had previously been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and even after administering a comprehensive, thorough diagnostic interview, we were unable to find evidence of that.
So Zimmerman studied 145 people. They'd come to the hospital after someone else diagnosed them as bipolar.
About half, we did not confirm the diagnosis.
Most had some form of depression, but they didn't seem to be bipolar. To make sure, Zimmerman studied the patients' families. People who are bipolar tend to have close relatives with the same problem. But that pattern didn't hold for the people classified as misdiagnosed. Zimmerman will present his findings during a scientific session tomorrow. He says overdiagnosis is important because it can hurt people.
You don't want individuals to be treated for something that they don't have, because then they may be taking medications that they shouldn't be taking and therefore being exposed to side effects unnecessarily.
Side effects like tremor, weight gain, sedation, or liver problems. Zimmerman says he's not sure why so many people are being mistakenly put in the bipolar category these days. But one factor could be educational sessions for doctors, especially the ones sponsored by drug makers.
Almost invariably, there will be these admonitions of don't miss the diagnosis and a citation of a number of studies in which under-recognition and under-diagnosis is highlighted.
Another scientist presenting research on misdiagnosis was Gary Sachs of Harvard. Between talks, he explained that the symptoms of bipolar disorder are a bit like the stars in a constellation.
When you see them together, you recognize the Big Dipper. If you're only going to look at one or another star, it's hopeless to sort that out.
Sachs says that in academic settings, doctors use a long and highly structured interview to identify all those stars.
On the other hand, if you were to go out into ordinary clinical practice, you would see the process is nothing like that. It's less of the formal question and more of a general discussion.
He says that can lead to overdiagnosis. It can also mean that some people who actually have bipolar disorder aren't being treated for it.
The sad reality is that when patients aren't treated, they lose relationships, they lose jobs, they often lose marriages, sometimes they lose their life. So there's quite a bit at stake, and it's a very serious proposition.
Sachs says there's really no excuse for diagnostic sloppiness. The tools to accurately diagnose bipolar disorder have been around for 30 years. John Hamilton, NPR News.